It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 42 degrees, it's rainy, it's foggy, it's misty. We have winds coming from the southeast at 10 miles per hour. At the airport, they indicate they have 6 miles of visibility. Look for rain for the rest of the day, rain overnight too, and rain through about 4 p.m. tomorrow. That rain could be heavy at times. 3/4 to 1 inch is expected to fall today. Same amount tonight. And they are predicting blustery southeast winds, 20 gusting to 30 miles per hour. Coming up on the Midday Report, lawmakers in the State House have their own version of Governor Mike Dunleavy's budget, but it's still a work in progress.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Congress is ending a historic shutdown at the Department of Homeland Security. Today, the House approved a bill to fund DHS minus immigration enforcement through the end of the fiscal year. The measure was approved with a voice vote after weeks of delays and infighting among Republicans on the path forward to fund the agency. U.S. House primaries in Louisiana are suspended. That day from Republican Secretary of State Nancy Landry in the wake of yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court ruling in which a conservative majority struck down an election map that was redrawn to create a second majority black congressional district in Louisiana. Landry says other state primaries will proceed as scheduled. For a second day, Pentagon officials were on Capitol Hill. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports senators grilled the defense secretary about the war with Iran and a huge proposed defense budget increase.
Secretary Pete Hegseth cited high military recruiting numbers as evidence of support for the Iran war. Senators like New York Democrat Kirsten Gillibrand pushed back.
What I'm concerned about is we are not safer, and I would just like to know why you have not sought the support of the American people, and 3 out of 5 Americans are against this war today.
I believe we do have the support of the American people, and we have briefed regularly what this mission looks like and why it's critically important that we undertake it.
Gillibrand pointed to the errant U.S. airstrike that killed more than 100 Iranian schoolgirls and Iran's blockade driving up prices as reasons the war is unpopular. Hegseth said the biggest U.S. adversaries are Democrats and some Republicans who doubt the war. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
The U.S. economy grew faster in the first 3 months of the year than at the end of 2025. NPR's Scott Horsley reports on the latest GDP figures from the Commerce Department.
The U.S. economy grew at an annual rate of 2% in the first 3 months of the year. That's a little bit slower than forecasters had expected, but a marked improvement from the final 3 months of last year, when growth was hampered by the 6-week government shutdown. Consumer spending grew at an annual rate of 1.6% during the first quarter. Business investment was up sharply as companies continue to pour money into data centers and artificial intelligence. The ongoing stalemate in the Strait of Hormuz continues to push crude oil prices higher. AAA says retail gasoline prices jumped another 7 cents overnight to a national average of $4.30 a gallon for regular. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Iran's national soccer team is set to compete in the World Cup. The administration's given mixed signals about their entry to the U.S. At the White House today, the president said, let him play.
You can have him. You don't have to have him. Probably have a good team. I don't know. Do they have a good team? Do you have any idea?
I have no idea.
Would be hard to believe, actually. But I think let him play.
The U.S., Mexico, and Canada are co-hosting the World Cup this summer. This is NPR News.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
For KMXT News, I'm Terry Haynes. At least 16 candidates are vying to be the next governor of Alaska in this year's primary election. One of those, Republican candidate Adam Crum, came through Kodiak earlier this month. KMXT's Davis Hubby spoke with the former State Revenue and Department of Health Commissioner on April 14th and has this report.
Adam Crum, born and raised in Alaska. I was born in Homer. I grew up in Anchor Point. So little coastal community. We joke that Anchor Point's a village on the road system. But running for governor and threw my name into the ring after a very diverse career.
How would you address or intend to address some of the issues that are plaguing the commercial fishing sector as a whole? I mean, poor ex-vessel prices, processors consolidating, shutting down, Russian seafood impacting the markets, et cetera, et cetera.
I had a friend and advisor early on in this process said, Adam, don't be an expert on fish. You can't. This is a subject that there's so many people that their entire livelihoods and generations of time arguing and fighting about this stuff. And so I've tried to just educate myself as much as possible and to learn from all sectors. There's not a lot of levers that the governor actually has, especially because most of our issues are dealing with international waters and treaties and other countries. And the goal is to try to actually learn as much as possible. My being a science background, I do appreciate the value of science and having a direct science-based initiative that is objective as possible. We need to try to actually come back to neutral and recognize that who we're fighting against is not necessarily out-of-state corporations, as they say, but it's really your friends and neighbors. These are fellow Alaskans. And I don't have any good answers on that other than the fact of trying to keep the rhetoric down and to make sure that we're looking at this from an objective viewpoint to try to find answers and try to make sure that we are actually showing action.
And talking more about rural Alaska, obviously the cost of living is high in Alaska, period. But especially for rural communities, you know, we've seen struggles with the housing market and the cost of fuel is going up, the cost of groceries, obviously, et cetera. But how would you sort of prioritize cost of living as governor?
You have to prioritize where the population is. And the reason is, the question was, how do you actually drive down shipping costs from bringing things either on containers or barges down here to Kodiak? And the reality is, the more strength and diversified the economy is on the rail belt, where 70% of the population is, that means goods are cheaper into Anchorage, and therefore it's cheaper down here to Kodiak and then shipped out. The coastal communities do not have the population size to really drive that market share, but if we actually can get it down as cheap as possible getting to Anchorage, that's really what we want. And so a lot of what my focus has been on economic development and diversification, a lot of it around infrastructure building.
What do you see as some of the burgeoning industries? I mean, are you focused more on resource development, the LNG pipeline, some other project that maybe we haven't tapped into yet as a state?
My thing that I'm really pursuing, AI data centers. I've talked to the Amazon Web Services head of energy strategy, and I've talked to folks like that, as well as hyperscalers, these groups that build these massive projects. And in Texas, where they're putting these things up, 40% of their operating costs is cooling. 25% is the cost of water. Well, what do we got in Alaska in abundance? We got cold and we got water. We have like 40% of the U.S. surface freshwater. And so we can create this industry that can come in and really fill the gap in all areas of the state, large size, small size. And my goal is to make Alaska the Silicon Tundra.
As far as education funding goes, where do you stand on the amount that you think is the best, I guess, for base student allocation? What amount would you support and what do you think the funding should be for BSA?
My idea is not to increase the BSA funding. Part of the BSA funding, the most expensive part of that, is the CTE, Career and Technical Education Training. So I would actually break out the CTE funding from the BSA and increase that and do it as a direct line item tied to key performance indicators to school districts, with the goal being that every small town has a fab shop, has a welding shop, has a machine shop.
And my final question is just sort of your one-minute elevator pitch to voters, to listeners. Why should they elect you as the next governor of Alaska?
My two reasons for running are named Ellie and Lucy. I've got little kids. They came late. I still got one in diapers. And I want to build a state that my daughters can grow old in and hopefully my grandkids. And I think that I've met more and more Alaskans that are just tired of this managed decline. We have been stagnant since 2014. We need to actually make sure that we are taking control of our destiny, breaking out of this boom-bust cycle, And the difference between myself and the other candidates, you hear a lot of very similar topics and a lot of same things. No one has my background and experience. The private sector, both as a company owner, as a company founder, exiting companies, running the largest department in the state of health, $3.5 billion budget, 3,500 employees, moving into the finance side and understanding exactly where the money in for the state comes from.
Again, that was gubernatorial candidate Adam Crum speaking with KMXT's Davis Hubby earlier this month. You can hear the full conversation online at kmxt.org. The primary election is August 18th, and the top four candidates, regardless of party affiliation, will advance from there to the general election on November 3rd. State House lawmakers rolled a new draft of Governor Mike Dunleavy's proposal for cutting taxes for the Alaska LNG project on Monday. The House Resources Committee's version would raise more money for the state and local communities than Dunleavy's proposal, but far less than the draft under consideration in the Senate. All three would replace the existing 2% annual statewide property tax on oil and gas infrastructure with a tax on the amount of gas running through the project. It's an effort to make the 800-mile pipeline export facility and gas treatment plant competitive in a global market for liquefied natural gas. But legislators and local officials say they're concerned that too much tax relief or a poorly structured bill could lead local property and sales taxpayers to subsidize the $46 billion project. Committee co-chair Robin Nayuk-Freer, a Democrat from Utqiagvik, says the new version is a work in progress, but she says she's trying to find common ground. The House Resources Committee's draft would impose a total tax about three times larger than what Dunleavy proposed, a total of 20 cents per 1,000 cubic feet of gas for export, and a lower tax on in-state gas. The bill would also make that tax relief conditional on a number of things, most notably the construction of a spur pipeline to Fairbanks. The spur line is estimated to cost $150 to $200 million, and including it in the cost of the overall project would add only about 2 cents to the cost of gas from the project, according to the legislature's oil and gas consultant. It's unclear whether a spur line would pencil out if it's not included in the overall project. The bill would also give the North Slope Borough and Kenai Peninsula Borough, which would host the gas treatment plant and export facility, the option to buy equity in the project instead of receiving tax revenue. Representative Julie Coulombe, an Anchorage Republican, says there's still work to be done. Officials with the state agency that owns 25% of the project, the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, said the new version represented real progress toward a workable bill, but they said the higher tax rate presented a, quote, challenge, close quote, to the economics of the project. Dunleavy's communications director, Jeff Turner, said in a statement that the administration and the House committee were, quote, working productively on streamlining the bill, close quote. But he said weighing down the project with conditions and higher taxes made the pipeline less likely to happen. A walk to raise awareness for missing and murdered Indigenous people is set for this evening at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Event organizer Michelle Yachmenoff is an Alaska Native Success Coordinator and COO of ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, which is located at the UAA campus. This is the event's third year. Participants plan to walk a short loop carrying posters and drumming to spread awareness of missing and murdered Indigenous people, and to remember missed loved ones. The event is scheduled to begin at 5:30 p.m. with a performance from Chupik dancers and drummers at the ANSEP building on Spirit Way. Yachmenoff says she will be carrying the photo of a missing person whose family is unable to make it to the event. She says that being asked was special and heartfelt. Tatiana Ticknor, Program Director with Data for Indigenous Justice, is set to deliver a speech to the MMIP Walks participants. The project aims to reclaim data on missing and murdered Indigenous people. The Anchorage Assembly welcomed three new members with a swearing-in ceremony on Tuesday night. With the certification of the April election finalized, newcomers Sidney Scout, Janice Park, and Donald Handeland took the oath of office on Tuesday to represent North Anchorage, Midtown, and Eagle River Chugiak, respectively. They were joined by incumbents Anna Brawley of West Anchorage, East Anchorage's George Martinez, and Zach Johnson from South Anchorage, who all won re-election. After they were sworn in, Brawley was the sole member nominated to be the new assembly chair, replacing Chris Constant. Brawley said she looked forward to building on the momentum her predecessors started. Daniel Voland of North Anchorage was chosen to replace Brawley as vice chair, with 8 members voting in favor. Johnson received 4 votes. Outgoing members Constant, Felix Rivera, and Scott Myers all received standing ovations from meeting attendees following their farewell remarks. Rivera and Constant were also both presented with citations from the Alaska legislature honoring their 9 years of service on the assembly. An Anchorage police officer has been charged with driving under the influence more than a month after a fellow officer reported he had driven his patrol vehicle while drunk. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports.
41-year-old Charles Bowser faces one misdemeanor criminal count after the March 9th incident in which a test of his blood showed a level of alcohol more than 3 times the legal limit. The investigation started when Bowser's fellow police officer, who's also his neighbor, called a police sergeant to report that Bowser appeared to be intoxicated when he pulled his patrol vehicle into his driveway, according to a charging document. He was off duty at the time. Other officers found Bowser slumped over on his front steps, according to the charges. Bowser told them he didn't know how much he'd had to drink, but said that he'd been drinking hard liquor. Bowser exhibited signs of a, quote, high level of intoxication, including bloodshot eyes and slurred speech, the charges say. Medics took Bowser to a hospital. His blood alcohol level was 0.29, more than 3 times the legal limit of 0.08. Police say they found an empty package in the vehicle that had originally contained 10 small bottles of 99-proof alcohol and an almost empty bottle of whiskey. The patrol car had a built-in video system that activates whenever the vehicle hits 80 miles per hour, which Bowser allegedly reached multiple times. Officers reviewed the system and saw footage of the vehicle swerving dangerously, running multiple stop signs, hitting snowbanks, and of Bowser buying alcohol from a liquor store, the charges say. Anchorage police officials say Bowser is on administrative leave pending an internal investigation. He's been on the police force since 2014. They declined to comment further on the incident. Bowser is scheduled to make an initial court appearance May 22nd. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Two groups of Juneau residents filed proposed citizen propositions this week in hopes of putting questions on the 2026 local election ballot. Both proposed questions are aimed at undoing some of the consequences of ballot measures that voters approved last election. KTOO's Clarice Larson has more.
Hi, we'd like to turn in an affidavit.
Come on in.
Pat Race and 4 other residents walk into the city and borough of Juneau's clerk's office with a handful of paperwork late Tuesday morning. City Clerk Brecken Hendricks stamps each page. The group is there to drop off a proposed ballot proposition that seeks to reverse a decision voters approved during last fall's local election.
Last year, we decided to change it from the cap from 12 mils to 9 mils, and what this does is it just simply flips that back.
Last election, voters approved a ballot measure that placed a cap on the city's property tax rate, also known as the mill rate. Voters also passed another proposition that exempts essential food and residential utilities from local sales tax. An advocacy group called the Affordable Juneau Coalition brought forth both propositions. The goal was to make Juneau more affordable by reducing the tax burden on residents. But reducing those taxes means the city is taking in $10 to $12 million less in revenue annually. Ray says that's a problem.
You know, when we start cutting so deep that we're losing the icing on the cake, I think that it's important to realize that we've overstepped and to step it back a little bit.
Last week, the Assembly began contemplating a list of more than 40 city services that could be on the chopping block, including some recreational facilities, slashing local grants, and more.
I think the list of potential cuts has been really sobering for people, and I don't envy the Assembly members for having to make some of the decisions that they're facing.
That's Alita Buss, one of the 5 people who signed on to support the reversal proposition. She and other members of the group say losing those services would erode what makes Juneau an attractive place to live. That's why they created the proposed ballot proposition that would reverse the mill rate cap and restore some of the long-term revenue loss the city is now facing, along with potential service cuts.
We do value these things and want to take little ones to the field house and play soccer there, or, you know, the city museum's on the chopping block. There's all kinds of stuff that just is concerning.
And they're not the only people in town who want to undo what transpired in the last election. Michael Cole is one of five residents who are proposing a different ballot measure. It seeks to implement a 1% seasonal sales tax in Juneau during the summer tourism months. Right now, the city taxes residents at 5%.
With all the proposed cuts to recreation here in Juneau, it very quickly became apparent that we needed that to be minimal.
Cole says the group of signers is made up of parents concerned with how the potential service cuts could impact their kids' well-being, especially the proposed closure of recreational facilities like pools and the Diamond Park Fieldhouse. He says the 1% seasonal sales tax is aimed at financially supporting the city's recreational facilities. Last year, voters shot down a ballot proposition that also sought to implement a seasonal sales tax system in Juneau, but at a much more dramatic level than that 1% bump Cole and the other signers are proposing. He says that's the point.
Yeah, it seems like it's something that was going to be affordable and yet also would bring in some good revenue. And most of that revenue, the bigger chunk of it, would come from the cruise industry.
Angela Rodell, a member of the Affordable Juneau Coalition, calls the two proposed propositions premature and reactionary to the proposed cuts, which are still up in the air. And she says she's skeptical that the groups will be able to gather enough signatures to get it on the ballot.
This is what happens when you stir up people and go after the most popular things right away.
Both proposed ballot propositions still need to undergo a legal review by the city attorney and be certified by the city clerk. If the proposals are certified, each group has 30 days to collect just under 2,600 signatures of support for the propositions to appear in Juneau's municipal election on October 6th. In Juneau, I'm Clarice Larson.
Mount Edgecombe High School is cutting staff for the second year in a row amid ongoing budget and enrollment issues. While last year's position cuts were mostly refilled at the end of the summer, administrators say they'll only rehire for the cut positions this year if more students enroll. KCAW's Hope McKinney has this report.
The state-run boarding school in Sitka serves students from across the state, the majority of whom are Alaska Native from rural communities without local high schools. News of deteriorating facilities and an exodus of roughly a quarter of its students over the past year prompted state legislators to visit the campus in February and hold hearings to question school leadership. In an alumni advisory board meeting on April 23rd, school superintendent David Langford, who was hired last summer, said that new student applications have slowed to a trickle.
Right now, we're at 37% below where we are normally at this time for new applications coming in. So, yeah, that's lower than what it has been before, and that's what's driving us to look at alternative budget projections.
In response to dwindling enrollment, Langford said the school has cut several positions, and he's not sure how many they'll be able to refill. Langford said as of now, six teachers won't be returning. Two are retiring, one is moving, and three non-tenured teachers were given the option to either resign or be, quote, non-retained, which means they're not being offered a contract for next year.
It's important to note that nobody's getting fired. That's a whole different category, which means really we don't want you to ever teach anywhere again, basically. In that category, and we're not doing that to anybody.
In an interview with KCAW, Langford said if enrollment exceeds their projections, they may look at hiring all six positions back.
We live off of the enrollment, and that's how we get funding. So if we don't have students coming in, we can't fund teachers.
Matt Hunter, president of the union representing teachers, said a non-retention can happen for any non-tenured teacher for any reason. He said the cuts that happened last spring and the upcoming cuts for next school year are strictly budgetary.
This year's reductions came from some budget issues that we ran into last year. We had some overspending and we were relying on COVID funds that had expired and weren't there any longer. And that's why we had such big cuts between last year and this year. And looking forward, in order to budget wisely, you have to look at how many applications you have and how many kids you're likely to have. or you'll promise the job that they'll want, and then find out in August you can't afford it, which would be terrible.
Hunter said when families hear bad news about the school, enrollment goes down. But recent news coverage of Mount Edgecombe's challenges only tells part of the story.
We have students who are some of the most genuine, kind people I've ever met, and we have good stuff happening in our classrooms. We offer some really neat classes. I think it's going to be a good school next year. We're still going to have good teachers. We're going to have wonderful students. We just need people to come.
Langford said the biggest priority moving forward is rebuilding enrollment by showcasing how special Mount Edgecombe is.
Yes, we might have fewer students next year than normal, and that would be a rebuilding year to build back culture and pride and, you know, all the kinds of things that maybe we're lacking this year.
Mount Edgecombe lets out on May 8th for the summer break and reconvenes in late August. Langford said despite current enrollment numbers, he's optimistic about the year to come. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Hope McKenney.
From May 9th through May 18th, no-cost medical, dental, behavioral health, and optometry services will be available in Kodiak and surrounding villages as part of the Arctic Care Mission hosted by Kodiak Area Native Association. In Kodiak, schedule appointments online at kodiakhealthcare.org. Village residents can schedule services through their local clinic. Check out kodiakhealthcare.org and the CANA Facebook page for more information.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Thursday. It is the 30th day of April, the year 2026. The sun rose today at 6:19. It will set again at 9:55. That will give us 15 hours and 35 minutes of glorious daylight. A gain of 4 minutes and 40 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high temperature for this date was 61 degrees, set in 1995. And our record low is 26, set in 1951, then again in 1985, and then again in 2013. It is currently 42 degrees. It is damp and foggy, misty, southeast winds at 10 miles per hour at the airport, where they continue to have 6 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is predicting this rain will continue all day and all night and into tomorrow till about 4 p.m. Southeast winds today and tonight about 20, gusting to 30. Look for a high today of about 44, overnight low about 42. And for tomorrow, look for south winds to 15, high of 46. Saturday, just a chance of rain with mostly cloudy skies. And then on Sunday, rain is likely. Rain is also likely for Monday and Tuesday. Back to a chance of rain on Wednesday. We have an incoming tide. Our next high tide will be at 2:29 this afternoon here on the east side. That will be a 7.1-foot tide, followed by a low tide at 7:56 of 1.5 feet. Over on the west side, your next high tide will happen at 2:54 p.m. and be 12.6 feet, followed by a low tide at 8:41 of 2 feet. There will be a Kodiak Island Borough Assembly work session tonight at 6:30 p.m., followed by a special meeting that will be happening in the Borough Assembly Chambers. The packet is available at the Kodiak Island Borough website. Call the clerk for more information at 486-9310.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 3 times a day. Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.